in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of January 10th, 2016. I'm Kurt Franklin, Executive Editor at Information Week, and your host for today's episode. It's going to be a wonderful episode. First of all, we want to welcome everyone to Information Week Live in 2016. The happiest of New Year's to you. This is our first episode of the new year. The reason for that we'll explain in just a bit. But first, I want to introduce my panelists. We've got a select panel today because, frankly, we've got a holiday weekend coming up, and lots of folks at Information Week are busy putting together stories for the upcoming holiday weekend. Fortunately, my fellow executive editor and I are able to pry ourselves away from the keyboard long enough to come and enjoy this time with you. And that lets you know that my guest today is executive editor for community at Information Week, Dave Wagner. Dave, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thanks, Kurt. Though it makes me feel like I'm clearly not doing my duty by skipping this call and writing an article.
Well, I should. I have a feeling I'm going to get a nudge from our devoted managing editor sometime in the next hour. I've got a story that I'm in process on. But, you know, we're just going to have to let that wait because Information Week Live is just that important. And 2016 is going to be a great year for Information Week Live because we are launching the podcast version of Information Week Live. Now, our followers have been able to listen to us live every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. Also, they've been able to listen to us streaming from either informationweek.com or from blogtalkradio.com. They're the folks who provide the service that lets us bring Information Week Live to you. But starting within the next couple of weeks, we're also going to be available via podcast. Now, that's going to be available here at Information Week. It'll also be available on iTunes, on the Google Play Store, all kinds of places if you want to download these episodes and listen to them at your leisure. We had heard from a lot of folks that they wanted to be able to get Information Week Live that way, and we're happy to make it possible. So lots of good stuff going on. Dave, I'm going to turn to you real quickly. We're 2 weeks into 2016. Has there been anything that has struck you as particularly either wonderful or worrying so far in this new year?
Personally, I was sad that I went to the East Coast for my Christmas vacation and saw no snow. but on a larger level, I'm sure I want to hear about your adventures at CES. But before that, I was quite thrilled with President Obama suggesting a $4 billion incentive package to help bring driverless cars, autonomous vehicles, whatever word you want to use, to the American highways. At the same time, there was a great story on Information Week about Ford being the first to test autonomous vehicles in the snow, which I thought was very important. We often think about autonomous vehicles like the Google car driving around in San Francisco, where, you know, it's substantially easier to deal with the weather. Those two things gave me a lot of encouragement that I will see a driverless car in my lifetime. I was starting to doubt that a little bit.
Well, you mentioned CES, and it was interesting to see the number of automobiles, including autonomous automobiles at CES. I had a chance to talk to one of the software engineers at Ford. There will be an article on that up any minute now. And I was fascinated in talking to him. He was explaining that there are all kinds of issues that have to be dealt with in, as he put it, building the picture of the world around the car. You know, according to him, that's really where the whole issue starts. They have to be able to create this 3D, constantly shifting image that the decision-making portions of the system can work on. We talked about the difference in the problem for highways, where, as he said, it's things are moving fast, but it's a relatively simple environment,
right,
versus urban areas where your speeds are lower, but the environment, the image around the vehicle is so much more complicated. It was an interesting conversation with him, made more so by the fact that we kept being interrupted by people. There was just such great interest in autonomous vehicles at CES that we would get about, three or four sentences into one of his answers, and someone would just pop up and tap him on the shoulder and go, "Hey, tell me about this." or offer a suggestion. Gee, you really should be doing your car like this. And he would engage them. I have to say that one of the interesting parts about the "you should be doing your car like this," people were asking why they didn't just bring over all the technology from the driver assist technologies. You know, all of the "we'll brake for you, we'll help you park, we'll do this, that, and the other" for the driver. He explained that assisting a human driver and creating a virtual driver are two entirely separate problems.
Right.
And so there's really very little in the way of algorithm and code that can be exchanged between the two. Obviously, there are some sensors in common, but from a software point of view, they're two very, very different things.
Right, because if it's something as simple as blind spot assistance, you go to turn, a radar or a laser says there's something where you want to go, stop. That's a simple decision. That's a yes, no, don't do kind of thing. But that's an entirely different decision than an autonomous vehicle saying, "I would like to change lanes now. How do I do that?"
Right, right. There's an awful lot of decision-making that goes on in the driver's head that, once you get out of driver's ed class, tends not to happen consciously.
Right.
And, you know, when I think about the problem, and I have written some code, although not of this sort, but when I think about the problem, it's trying to emulate the unconscious decision-making that's really the hard part.
Right, because there's no such thing as an unconscious for a computer.
That's right, at least not that we're aware of.
Right, or basically what we think of as unconscious is a series of subroutines that are running beneath our surface. There is no beneath the surface. Everything is on the surface for an algorithm. They can manage more than one thing, but they're managing it with full attention, because that's how computers work, whereas we work differently, or at least our perception of how we work is different.
Ah, there you go. That's a deep discussion for another show.
Right.
but, you know, I'm glad you asked me about CES, because enjoy is not quite the right word when I talk about going to CES. It is pretty much always a productive time for me. I will find individuals there and topics there that I will use for stories for the next 6 months. And so from that perspective, it was quite wonderful. I got to see people who I only see once a year. According to my iPhone, it was the healthiest week I've had in a long time, because I walked miles upon miles every day. But I have to say, for me, it was a story of two shows. Because on the one hand, if you go over to the vast Las Vegas Convention Center, which is I think still the largest exhibition space under one roof in the country. And it was just jammed full of exhibits, including the exhibitions from the big consumer electronics companies, you know, the Samsungs, the Sonys, GE, you know, as well as Intel and Ford and General Motors. You know, they all had just enormous booths that covered the kind of floor space that you could easily use to build a suburban home on. Those were wonderful, and the spectacle was really amazing, and you could just sort of walk by and be overwhelmed by what was on display. But then there was the Sands Expo, and upstairs at the Sands was similar, but on a slightly smaller scale, but similar to what was going on at the LVCC. Downstairs, though, was where you got to the other show. Because downstairs, they had made this entire show floor of 10 by 10 booths. Now, that's sort of the atomic unit of a trade show booth. Every one of them had some startup, some entrepreneur bringing their product to market. And there was a section in here there called Eureka Park that was all about companies that had not existed at this time last year. Kickstarter had a section of companies there. GoFundMe had a section. There was even a stage where entrepreneurs could get up and make their pitch for people to fund them. But this whole thing was, I described it to several people as a capitalist mosh pit because it was just elbow to elbow. And the owners of the companies were there trying to grab your attention, trying to make their pitch to all of the buyers coming by. And, of course, I had a media badge on, so they wanted to get their word out via media. It was frustrating for anyone bothered by crowds. It would have been terrifying, but it was so exciting to feel the energy down there, even knowing that many of the things I was looking at have no chance at success. I'm sorry, there are only so many ways you can repackage rubber bands to tie an iPhone to a bicycle handlebar. But with that aside, you also know that there are some products down there that are going to succeed. And just seeing the excitement, seeing the international flavor of both the booths and the buyers down there, it was really exciting. So that was the part of the show that I came closest to enjoying. But right. The entire show was something I was just happy to survive.
Well, it's the $2 trillion gold rush, right? And what you got to see is something we don't see as much anymore with the internet, which is you actually got to see the physical manifestation of a gold rush, right? You know, Gartner says the Internet of Things is going to be worth $1.9 trillion over the next, I believe, 5 years, at 10 at the most. I forget what the number is. And right now, no one, not even the big companies, can really claim a lot of ground on the consumer side of the Internet of Things. I mean, there's Nest, and there are a few other notable examples of successful IoT products. But for the most part, when it comes to the consumer side of IoT, it is still an open field. And it's exciting because with 3D printing, making faster prototypes, with a huge percentage of these products being driven by software as opposed to having a physical product or those physical products being cheaper to make, there is no barrier. There is a much smaller barrier to entering this market. And so suddenly it's a place where good ideas are wanted, needed, are lucrative. It's a very exciting thing. And, you know, I like that you got to see a physical manifestation of that, because usually I only see it in my email box every Monday from PR person after PR person asking me to cover their IoT product.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned your inbox. I was fascinated. I kept a separate email folder for press releases, and I received between 1,300 and 1,400 press releases regarding CES. It truly is amazing, and it's nice to see. I spoke last year to Chris Anderson, who had been the chief editor at Wired, and he wrote a book on makers. And he was talking about the fact that you can have a business based on smaller numbers than the industrial giants have to have. It's one thing to have a business that will support a family. It's another thing to look at business from the perspective of something that will support several million shareholders plus a couple of hundred thousand employees. And seeing those, as you say, those smaller companies is exciting. It's also interesting at CES to sort of get a look into the guts of the industry, because there are somewhere between dozens and scores, maybe even hundreds, of companies that are there that are Chinese or Taiwanese, usually, manufacturers of generic consumer electronics devices. Now, some of these will sort of lapse over into the industrial or the enterprise level, because they will be manufacturing batteries or cases or cables, things like that. But it is amazing to see all of these companies and to understand that what has happened in each one of these is that a family or a group of families have pooled their resources and have created a company to do generic manufacturing. And what they're hoping to do is find someone who needs larger quantities than they can do on their 3D printer. So if you have a great idea and you get your Kickstarter, or maybe you just sell very well in your local town, but you want to make that next step, these are the companies you go to and talk with, because they will look at your product and, you know, they'll sit down on their little table in the booth there in Las Vegas and work out schedules and production quantities and all that. And I would say in most cases that if you struck a deal there, you could have your first prototype back by the end of this month. And it's sort of interesting to watch that part of the industry take place.
Right. Well, you know, you mentioned Chris Anderson. You were locked up in the at Interop and in the NOC. But while you were there, Chris Anderson spoke at Information Week conference last year in Vegas. Excuse me. And he talked about the rise of his company, his drone company. And it was an incredibly interesting story of a combination of luck and understanding opportunity. You know, he started building drones out of his own house just because he and his kids liked to do it. And there was a point where he realized that it was too big to continue to do in his house, and that he did not want to become a full-time drone kit mailer, which is what he was starting to become. And so he met this person online, and they struck up a conversation, and he started paying this young man to do this. And he was noticing they were making, you know, more money than he expected. And he was kind of happy, but he didn't really think anything of it. And then one day he was talking to this young man who was in Mexico, so they weren't in the same city. And the young man said, "Would you like to come down sometime to Mexico to see our clean room and to meet the team?" And Chris Anderson said, "I have a team, and we have a clean room." And the young man that he was working with. And I've written this whole story on Information Week. Search weaponized Lego drone and Information Week, and you'll find it. This young man had been reinvesting his own money into building larger facilities because he saw the potential. Well, Chris was just dabbling at first, and it was at that moment that Chris realized, I have to pay attention to this. This is real. And now I believe that they have the largest commercial drone company in the world, and in a very short period of time. And there's a certain amount of luck, because if he had found a different young man, that young man may not have been quite so ambitious. But also, Chris Henderson's a smart, smart guy who understands opportunity when he sees it. And he seized upon it in a really incredible way. And what's amazing is that manufacturing techniques are making that possible. It's possible for somebody to take the money from a small mail order business and turn it into a manufacturing center by themselves. That would not have been possible even just a few years ago.
Yeah, it really has changed manufacturing. And I say this as someone who grew up as a child. I would go to the small manufacturing company that my grandfather owned and spend Saturday morning there while he, you know, did paperwork. But today it is so much different and in many ways so much more exciting. So that was the piece that really thrilled me. I saw a lot of stuff. I truly believe, for example, that virtual reality and augmented reality are going to be more important this year than they have been. And the reason that I say that is twofold. The big one is that the cameras for creating 360-degree images are becoming much cheaper and much more ubiquitous. Polaroid was showing theirs. Nikon just introduced theirs. And these are single cameras in a single housing that will do it. So no more do you have to stick 16 GoPros in a ball configuration up on a stick in order to make this happen. And so I think that as more and more extreme athletes start taking images in virtual reality format, that will start to drive the desire for goggles or for a lot of people using things like Google Cardboard.
Yeah, Cardboard, I think, is big.
And, you know, to me, that will get, you know, will answer the chicken and egg problem.
Yeah.
It will be the extreme athletes who are the chicken. And so I'm very excited about that. The flip side is, I think one of the more disappointing things that happened during CES was the pricing news from
Oculus Rift.
Oculus Rift. Thank you. I was flipping over into Transformers and coming up with Optimus Prime. No. But Oculus Rift, because everyone I think was hoping that Oculus Rift would come in around $199, and it actually came in the 500s.
Yeah.
Now Samsung is using a lot of that technology, and their goggles are in fact lower priced, but those together, I think, make it likely that Google Cardboard is going to own the VR market for some time to come.
Well, and that's the other chicken and egg problem, right? Is I'm an avid gamer. I've been an avid gamer since Atari 2600. I would be perfectly happy to get into virtual reality gaming if somebody made the right helmet and the right games, right? But I don't want to pay $500 for a virtual reality helmet before there's a good game. And nobody wants to make a good game until somebody has plucked down $500.
Right.
So the problem with virtual reality in gaming, in entertainment, is the if you build it, we will come, isn't true. It's the if customers buy it, we will come. So what makes Google Cardboard so exciting is it's the entry level the aspirational VR lover opportunity. I can take a Google Cardboard, I can use it as a test to see why virtual reality matters, why do I want this, what is exciting about this, and then maybe after I get a little excited about it, I'll be willing to put down $200, $500 for an even better experience.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating that Google is one of two companies right now that I think are willing to put out products regardless of the price point, because Google did things both as Google Cardboard and Google Glass, which were kind of on the opposite ends of the pricing scale. They have the financial wherewithal to say, we're going to put this out and see what happens, and frankly, we don't care whether anyone buys them or not. The other company that has a history of doing that sort of thing is Apple. And yet, Apple has not, for decades, been big in gaming. And they show no real interest in getting into virtual reality, that sort of thing. So it is interesting watching the market dynamics as much as the technology right now. I did think it was fascinating today. A press release came across my desk, and I may do an article on this, from the IEEE, who ran a survey at CES. And according to the IEEE, they believe that goggles for virtual reality have a very finite lifespan. They think that probably within 4 or 5 years, we'll be at a point where you don't have to have goggles. Technology will have advanced to the point where goggles are not required for virtual reality. I don't know how much of that is a fervent wish on the part of CES attendees, but it is interesting to hear so many people say that not that virtual reality is going to go away, but goggles as a way of consuming virtual reality is going to go away.
Well, Microsoft's been working on this at least for 10 years, essentially what people would call a holodeck. So it makes sense to me that we would drop the goggles. I don't think 5 years sounds reasonable, but when I hear those kinds of predictions, I just automatically add 10 and think that's about right.
Well, that's comforting. About the time, when the time is getting right for me to sit down in a rocking chair somewhere in a home, I'll still be able to go out and experience the virtual world while I do it. So that works out well.
Yeah, well, that sounds like a way to stay young, too.
Yeah. Well, Dave, I've been sort of taking up all the time, and we're getting close to the end. What have you seen that strikes your fancy, that seems exciting to you?
Well, I just want to talk about a story that I'll have out probably later today or over the weekend that I think is really a very interesting way of solving a problem that has been plaguing the healthcare industry for decades. Chime, the College of Health Information Medical Executives, essentially a CIO organization of healthcare systems, has partnered with HeroX, which is an offshoot of the XPRIZE company, to create an XPRIZE for healthcare identification. So for people who forget, the XPRIZE was the prize that was given for the first commercial spacecraft to go into space. And at the time, it was designed to create a incentive for commercial space travel. And oh boy, did that work. We now have Elon Musk and Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos and all sorts of people in the commercial space business, and it was kind of exciting. Now, this probably is not going to get the attention of the XPRIZE originally, but it probably is solving an even more fundamental problem, which is the problem of identifying who somebody is when they walk into a healthcare setting. That doesn't sound like it should be all that hard, but Chime says that roughly 20% of the time that somebody walks through the door of their own doctor's office, their ID, their person, is not fully attached to all of their medical records correctly. There are a lot of different ways that that can happen. One is duplicate records, so that not all of the records are kept with that one person. Another is identity confusion, confusing one person with the same name and another, et cetera, et cetera. There are a lot of different ways that can happen. But they are offering $1 million to somebody who can come up with a permanent solution that will allow 100% correct identification of the patient. This is really important because it actually causes loss of life and very sick people. So the CEO of Chime has provided an example. He said, imagine you're a woman who goes in for an annual mammography, and you go in, get your test done, and the mammography provider is on a different EHR than the patient's doctor is. And so they confuse one woman with another, and they send the results of that mammogram to a different doctor. Well, the woman who took the mammogram doesn't hear back from her doctor, so she assumes everything's fine. The doctor doesn't get in touch with her because he assumes that she never got the test. So a year passes. Everybody thinks everything's fine. The patient comes in for another mammogram and discovers she's had cancer for a year and didn't know it.
Right.
That's a very real and very common, not common as in like an everyday occurrence, but a very real and very frightening example of how this can happen. And he says, within an individual healthcare system, the error rates are usually fairly low, like 5%. But even their best healthcare systems, when they start having to go outside of their own system, can experience error rates as high as 50%. So this is a very scary thing, and that's not even counting the money, because the CIOs are spending millions and millions of dollars to try to clean up this data. So I think this is a very exciting thing that they're trying to do to solve a problem that has only gotten worse with EHR rather than better. And they're offering $1 million to start that same kind of environment of innovation that was spurred by the original XPRIZE.
I agree with you. I think this is mighty interesting stuff. And thinking back to my experiences in healthcare and in the hospital, the whole identity thing is a bigger problem than most people want to think it is. Carol, my dear wife, noted that every time someone came into my room, the first thing they asked was, what was my name? They didn't trust the name on the door. They didn't trust anything. They wanted to confirm who I was and all that. And so this is something that is being dealt with in a very clumsy fashion in a lot of places, and having a better, more systematic way of dealing with it can be nothing but good.
Right. And here's the kicker as to why it is so clumsy. The federal government passed a law making it illegal to solve this problem.
Oh, good.
In the late 90s, they passed specifically a law saying that nobody could spend federal funding of any kind on creating a universal patient ID number. And the reason was, at the time that it was passed, there were concerns that a number like that, which would allow us to identify a patient, would actually cause more privacy violations than not having it. And it was probably a well-meaning thing, although I've heard an awful lot of people who were not willing to go on record saying it, but have said to me that they actually think that it may have to do with insurance companies not wanting it. But I can't verify that. I can't speak for the government when they pass the law. But since then, Chime has said they've been lobbying for over 10 years to get the federal government to change this law. And they've done it so many times that they've actually been told in meetings that if they bring it up one more time, the meeting is over. Because the congressional staffers and the healthcare professionals inside the government would have to say that this is spending money on solving that problem, which they're not allowed to do because it's against the law.
Yes.
Which is the kind of government thinking that scares me every time I think about a government.
Oh, heavens. Well, you know, we need to have, I think, a show coming up fairly soon on the issues of healthcare. And I'll tell you why. There are three things. One is this thing that you've just mentioned. Another, the biggest health industry IT conference in the country is coming up fairly soon. It's called HIMSS, and it will be happening in Las Vegas fairly soon. I've already started getting press releases from companies wanting to know if I will meet with them in the desert. And the third is, and this is something I'm got to go and do some more reading on. I've seen a number of things talking about the end of one of the major facets of the EHR laws, and that is the way that they're used in describing diagnoses. So I've got to do some reading, but it seems like we've got a lot of things coming together. So I think in a couple of weeks, or maybe early in February, we need to plan a healthcare-oriented episode of Information Week Live. What do you think, Dave?
I think it sounds great, and I actually may be going to HIMSS. We're discussing who on the staff is going to go. I volunteered, but there are others who are equally able to go, so I don't know who it is that will be going. But whoever goes to HIMSS should definitely be involved in that, because I have covered HIMSS in the past and found it eye-opening and a little scary, but also strangely comforting, because there are a lot of really dedicated healthcare IT professionals out there trying to solve these problems, regardless of whether they're allowed to by federal law or not. And Chime itself has 10 priorities for healthcare IT in the coming year. They're all very much worth talking about on the pages of iWeek and on this show. So I think that'd be a great idea.
Sounds like a plan. Well, Dave, I'm afraid we've reached the end of our time for this first episode of Information Week Live in 2016. What are you going to be doing in the coming week? Where should people be looking to see your byline on Information Week?
Yeah, well, one of the things that I've got either up or soon to be up is a review of video games for 2016 to look forward to. That's always a fun thing to do at the beginning of the year. I also, will have an article early next week about the kinds of skills that hiring managers are looking for in data scientists and analytics professionals. This is a big deal right now because there are a huge number of very nice job openings in analytics and data science that I'm sure our audience are very interested in getting, but there's a shortage of qualified people for them. So I'm hoping that we can do a good job of helping people who are interested connect with the skills they need so that we can fill this need.
Sounds like a plan, and I've got to ask, as I always do, I know that you're active on the social networks. Where can people find you on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or some really cool service that I don't even know about yet?
Well, I'm on all the cool ones, but I can't tell you what they are because they'd stop being cool. you can find me at GeekAndDave on Twitter, and you can find me on Information Week and AllAnalytics.com as well.
Outstanding. Well, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Kurt.
As for me, I've got some things coming up in the hopper at Information Week is a piece on that Ford autonomous car and what's inside it. Now, knowing that this is just a test bed, I still thought it was interesting to talk with engineers about what they're using for the virtual driver in their autonomous car experimental vehicle. And some interesting stuff. To be honest, it's the kind of stuff that you could put together yourself if you had, oh, let's call it a couple hundred years of collective automotive design wisdom. Got some more slideshows and articles coming up, sort of the tail end of the CES flurry. And then I'm going to be diving back into a lot of interesting stuff happening in the app dev world. There's just so much going on in the world of development, in the world of building applications, both on the server side and the client side. We do have a great deal coming your way. Now, to keep up with me, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm KG4GWA. LinkedIn, Curtis Franklin. Facebook, the same. And, of course, check me out at Information Week. Also, I want to remind you, be on the lookout for the podcast of Information Week Live starting very soon. You'll see word of that on informationweek.com. And we will, of course, be just social networking the living daylights out of that one. Well, for Dave Wagner and all of us here at Information Week and Information Week Live, I'm Kurt Franklin. Thanks for being with us. Hey, we will see you next week.